I am Neo. Welcome into the Skeptic Arena. Today is August 16th, 2009. The website is theskepticarena.com. Today's subject, Jurassic Bully. Pick on someone your own size. And you might have thought that the T-Rex would, but scientists now think it preferred to prey on baby dinosaurs. It was the biggest ever carnivore to stalk the land. Well, I have to interrupt this article because that's not true. The Spinosaurus was the largest ever carnivore to stalk the land. Now getting back to the article. And with banana-sized teeth and a set of jawbones that could swallow a kitchen table, T-Rex truly earned its name as King of the Dinosaurs. But now scientists may have uncovered T-Rex's dirty secret. It was a prolific baby killer. A study into the predatory habits and diet of the biggest and most ferocious of the dinosaurs, again, that's incorrect, has concluded that T-Rex and the other members of its carnivorous theropod family prefer to dine on juvenile prey, preferably small enough to eat whole. The Hollywood image of T-Rex, epitomized in Steven Spielberg's 1993 hit movie Jurassic Park, is of an aggressively agile giant that stalked and killed herbivorous animals of similar or even larger size, such as the three-horned Triceratops or the long-necked Diplodocus. These bloody encounters between lumbering giants may have made for dramatic imagery, but the reality was probably far different, according to two paleontologists who believe that T-Rex and the other massive meat-eating dinosaurs that hunted on two legs prefer to pick on animals far smaller than themselves. Titanic struggles between consenting adults may well have happened on some occasions. Again, I have to interrupt. I don't know that consenting adults is correct. It's far more likely that one of them was consenting and the other one was running at top speed. Back to the article. But a far more likely scenario is that the Tyrannosaurs preferred to tuck into small and unwary juveniles rather than their fully grown and dangerously armored parents, explains David Hone, a British-born paleontologist working in China. Modern predators mainly attack vulnerable young animals as they are inexperienced in evading predators, and this was probably the same in dinosaurs, said Dr. Hone. The young prey are easier to bring down, and the risk of injury to the predator is much lower. Working with Oliver Rahat of the Bavarian State Collection for Paleontology and Geology in Munich, Dr. Hone has reviewed the evidence, suggesting that T-Rex and its family went in for baby eating in a big way. The two scientists also suggest that baby eating was such a common behavior among the large predatory dinosaurs that it could explain why the remains of so few juvenile dinosaurs have been found in the fossil record. We conclude that, like modern predators, theropods preferentially hunted and ate juvenile animals, leading to the absence of small and especially young dinosaurs in the fossil record. The traditional view of large theropods hunting the adults of large or giant dinosaur species is therefore considered unlikely and such events rare. It is known from preserved dinosaur nests that they produced many offspring, and it is highly likely that most of them did not reach adulthood, with many of them falling prey to predators in their first few years of life. Finds of dinosaur nesting sites indicate that dinosaurs laid large number of eggs and thus had very high numbers of offspring, but little of this is reflected in the numbers of young in the fossil record. But the two scientists also believe that eating baby dinosaurs whole or in large pieces by digesting them with the help of their stomach acids gave T-Rex the added advantage of being able to utilize the minerals and nutrients stored in the bones of their small prey. This could also explain why scientists have found so few bite marks on fossilized dinosaur bones. If it was indeed the case that T-Rex and its ilk prefer to eat the bodies of juveniles whole or in large pieces, just like modern crocodiles and birds of prey such as eagles. What little evidence there is from the fossil record supports this, said Dr. Hone, although there are few records where we do have the bones of prey species preserved in the stomachs of carnivorous dinosaurs, they are from juveniles. Studies of dinosaur stomach contents and coprolites, which are fossil feces, also suggest that prey was indeed swallowed whole. Juvenile animals may have been systematically the primary prey of choice for the majority of theropods. And now we move to the science segment. Most infectious malaria strain came from chimps. The most malignant known form of malaria may have jumped from chimpanzees to humans, according to a new study of one of the most deadly diseases in the world. Malaria, a mosquito-borne illness, can be caused in humans by one of four strains of the Plasmodium parasite. More than 1 million people die from malaria each year. P. falciparum is the most virulent of these strains and accounts for nearly 85% of all malaria infections. Three of the four human strains are known to have originally come from Old World monkeys. The exact origins of P. falciparum have been a mystery. Researchers had thought that P. falciparum and P. ricinawi, the malaria strain found in chimpanzees, evolved independently from a common ancestor about 5 to 7 million years ago. But the new study has found that the human strain is actually a mutated form of the chimp strain. Current wisdom that P. falciparum has been in humans for millions and millions of years is wrong, said study co-author Nathan Wolfe. We now know that there was a point in time when this was primarily a disease in chimpanzees that jumped and took hold in humans. Wolf and his colleagues analyzed the tissue samples from 94 live, wild, and wild-born captive chimpanzees in Cameroon and Ivory Coast. 8 of the animals were found to have malaria. The team discovered that the human and chimpanzee strains have certain genetic similarities, but that the chimp strain is more genetically diverse. Further analysis placed all 133 variants of the P. falciparum found around the world under a single branch of the P. ricinawi family tree. And now the arena goes abroad. Today we go to Nairobi, Kenya. UN worker might face flogging. A Sudanese woman who works for the UN peacekeeping mission in Sudan's capital, Khartoum, is bracing to be flogged 40 times Wednesday as a punishment under Islamic law for wearing clothing causing harassment to the public sentiments. In an email, Lubna Ahmed Hussein said she is being charged for violating Article 152 of Sudan's criminal code, basically by wearing pants. She has invited local and foreign journalists to view her flogging if she is convicted. Reached on her cell phone Tuesday as she was driving home in traffic, Hussein sounded calm. "Maybe I'll be punished. The judge will decide," she said. "I'm not afraid." Islamic law governs most of the vast East African nation, although southern Sudan, where many people practice Christianity and indigenous religions, is exempt under the terms of a 2005 peace deal that ended a long North-South civil war. Hussein and 13 other women, including some southerners, were at Khartoum Cafe July 3rd when police ordered them to a police station. The women were all wearing pants. 2 days later, 10 of the women were called back to the station and lashed 10 times each. Women are occasionally punished for offenses to Islamic law in the capital, although police just as often look the other way at increasing numbers of young women wearing Western clothes at trendy outdoor cafes such as Ozone, where aid workers and the children of the ruling elite sip cappuccinos under a fine mist spray. Generally, it depends on the police on duty. Many of them are really tolerant, but there are some fundamentalists among them. President Omar Hassan al-Bashir's political coalition includes conservatives who prefer strict adherence to Islamic law. Almost 2 years ago, Bashir's government sentenced a British teacher to 15 days in jail for letting her 7-year-old students name a teddy bear Muhammad, the name of the Islam's prophet, but also one of the most common names in the Muslim world. Angry mobs called for the teacher to be sentenced to death, but she was eventually pardoned after an outpouring of international outrage. On Tuesday, a spokesman for Bashir's ruling National Congress Party said the judge in Hussein's case has some discretion. If she is convicted, yes, flogging is a possible punishment, said the spokesman. Lubna will be subject to whatever the court finds. And now we go to the religion segment. Dale Newman found guilty. A man who prayed for his dying daughter to recover from a treatable illness was found guilty this afternoon after more than 15 hours of deliberation. Dale Newman, age 47, of the town of Weston, was charged with second-degree reckless homicide in connection with the March 23, 2008 death of his 11-year-old daughter, Madeline Cara Newman. Prosecutors say that Newman failed in his duty to protect his daughter when he chose not to take her to a doctor after seeing she was seriously ill. Cara, as the girl was known, died from complications of undiagnosed diabetes. Doctors testified this week that she could have been saved up until her death if she had received fluids and insulin. Dale's wife, Leilani Newman, age 41, was convicted of the same charge on May 22nd. The charge carries a maximum 25-year prison sentence. And now for the final segment of the show, famous quotes. Today, Pierre Jules Renard, or as he is commonly known, simply Jules Renard, born 1864, died 1910 at the age of 46. Renard was a French author and member of the Académie Goncourt, most famous for the works Carrot Hair in 1894 and Natural Histories, 1896. Among his other works are The Pleasure of Breaking, 1898, and 8 Days in the Countryside, 1906. He was elected mayor of Chitry on May 15, 1904, as the socialist candidate and became member of the Académie Goncourt in 1907. He died of arteriosclerosis in Paris. And now for the quote from Jules Renard. I don't know if God exists, but it would be better for his reputation if he didn't. And now the arena welcomes back, all the way from the United Kingdom, guest number one. Welcome into the Skeptic Arena.
Thank you, Neo. Thank you for welcoming me, and it's lovely to be on your show. And the reason I rang up was it sounds like such fun, all funny ideas you bring up. It's a really good show so far. I've only caught the last 5 minutes, but I thought it was absolutely brilliant. Thank you.
Well, you can always download the podcast for what you missed. Have you ever downloaded any of Pat Condell's videos?
Never heard of him. Sounds interesting. Why would I want to do that? What does he do?
Well, I gather that you are an atheist, correct?
Absolutely not. I'm a skeptic. I'm skeptical about atheism.
Well, religiously speaking, I was talking about religious beliefs. What religious beliefs?
Oh, I'm not religious.
Yeah, so...
But I'm not an atheist. I'm a skeptic.
Okay, so would you call yourself an agnostic?
No. I'm skeptical about agnosticism, too.
Okay, do you believe in God?
I'm skeptical about that, him. Very skeptical.
Do you believe...
Because if he exists, I think he's a bit of a fraud.
Do you
a bit of a sham.
Do you believe that there exists a force that could be called God in the universe?
I'm pretty skeptical about it. Because if you call it God, you're immediately defining it in limited terms, and therefore it can't be God.
Well, then you might enjoy listening to Pat Condell, because religious believers would tend to be offended by him because he's an atheist.
Oh, if I haven't offended someone, a religious person, during the day, I can't sleep at night.
Well, then you'll probably get a lot of ammunition from Pat Condell.
This sounds like fun. I'll look him up. Thank you very much for the reference. I look forward to that.
By the way, Pat Condell is your countryman.
No.
Yes.
An interesting Englishman.
Yes.
Right? Oh, jolly good.
That's another reason why you might want to listen to him, because a lot of his stuff is directed towards what's going on in Britain. So I think that's another reason I mentioned him to you.
Ah, brilliant. Of course, very few people in England are religious. You know, it's like in America when they do polls, about 80 or 90% of people believe in God or whatever. And in England, like it's about 20 or 30%. Very few people go to church here in England, you know. It's a very irreligious place, England. It's not as if people are intelligently non-religious. It's just that they don't give a damn.
Well, you've fallen behind on what's happening in your country. If you go to Pat Condell's website, you will discover that what's been going on that you've apparently missed.
Well, I'm always eager to find out what I've missed, but what are you talking about?
Islam.
Oh, Islam. Well, of course, Islam is the new... because of course the Muslims are very religious, aren't they? Yes, of course.
And they believe in
surrender to the will of Allah, who is the absolute personality, to surrender to him and not actually act on their own individual initiative. It's a very strange way to live.
And they also have the intention of taking over the world, and they are in the process of doing that in Europe right now.
Oh, man. Look, hey, come on, why pick on the Muslims? I'll tell you some other people who are trying to take over the world, right? You got the Muslims? Absolutely right. Totally agree with you. I'll give you some more. The Catholics. I'll give you some more. The Jews. I'll give you some more. The Mormons. Do you want me to go on? I'm totally skeptical about what I would call the religion of materialistic science as well. I go all the way. Anything with an ism on the end, I'm skeptical of.
That contradicted your previous statement, though. You said that...
How dare you, sir?
To be a religion requires not having evidence to back up your worldview or your belief, whereas...
That's what... I make that... As a skeptic, I challenge science to be able to prove its basic fundamental assumptions about the nature of reality. I believe that it's just as much... I believe that science... Well, no, I don't believe. I propose that science is just as much a religion as Mormonism.
Now we found where we totally disagree.
That's fantastic. At last we've got there. Good.
That's the argument creationists give scientists. In order to bring science down to their level, because religion has no evidence, no religion has any evidence, it's all faith. In order to bring science down to their level, one of their most common arguments is that science is a religion, that it's a faith, and they use all these things to try to bring it down, when in fact science only accepts those things that have been proven to be true, which is the exact opposite of everything that religion believes. In fact, everything in science can be backed up by evidence, and nothing in religion can be backed up by evidence. So they couldn't be more opposite if you tried to make them so. So that argument that creationists use, that's the motive behind that argument. And they can get other creationists to believe them because they're going to go along with anything that their fellow creationists say.
All right. I'm sorry, but just pick up on one thing. I'll be very quick. Just because they're creationists and belong to their own religion doesn't mean that they can't use it a valid argument in deconstructing the claims to objectivity of science. Their arguments may well be good. For instance, you can have two people both accusing each other of crimes, and they can both be right.
The reason that creationists attack and accuse science is because the discoveries of science have almost invariably proven that their beliefs are false.
Good. You see, this is the way, from my point of view, as the ultimate skeptic, at least I do the best I can, and I'm not accusing you of anything. I'm just saying I try hard. I mean, great. Science has conclusively disproved undercut the claims of all religions. Brilliant. Absolutely right. And I would say that I could undercut the claims of science to be anything other than a fantastic, fantasy-ridden, power-seeking religion, and I wouldn't have to be a fundamentalist Christian to say that. I could just use cool, hard, philosophical logic. And I'm not the only one. There's lots of philosophers who have that approach. Science isn't the only philosophy around that claims to be truthful.
The philosophical attacks don't rely on evidence. They rely on the redefinition of words and the twisting of logic. In other words, being clever. They try to be clever and deceitful. And that's their method of attack.
Can I have a go without being clever and deceitful? I don't want to be clever and deceitful because that is just stupid and lying and horrible.
Well, that's what they do.
To me, the whole point of skepticism is to get rid of lies and fantasies, and what is left that can't be got rid of must be have some substratum of truth to it. I'm a truth seeker.
So give me an example of something that you do accept as a fact or truth.
All right, I don't accept. Let me start off with the negative.
Well, no, you've already made it clear that almost everything is negative. I'm wondering what is there that's positive. I understand that everything's in your negative column. I want to hear something that's in your positive column.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much for asking. And let me reply simply and directly in saying that I myself, as an observer and a subjective receiver of information from my own senses, including hearing through which I am communicating with you, so I accept my own reality as myself, and I accept your own reality as yourself. I accept you and me as real. Anything else right now I would say is phenomena arising out of the reality of you and me. I'm in a sense, that sort of phenomenologicalism or something. You know, in the sense that I see, all right, I'll be frank, I see, I experience, I feel reality as existing as a substratum of mind.
This sounds very similar to the Hindu concept of Brahman.
Oh, gosh, you're clever and you're perceptive. I'm not a Hindu, but I totally approve of a lot of the... To me, the Hindus, if you're going to have a religion, you may as well be a Hindu. That's a proper religion. And the other thing about the Hindus is that they don't rely on faith. They don't ask you to believe anything. They say if you want to go into metaphysics, meditation, yoga, whatever, you know, here are the techniques. Go for it, and you don't have to believe anything. Have fun. Enjoy your life. Goodbye.
I agree. In fact, I think I may have mentioned to you that I'm trying to get a book published, and one of the...
Really? No, I didn't know that. Go on.
Yeah, it's a, you know, creationist, evolutionist controversy. You know, in America, that's a big deal, creation, evolution. The rest of the world's laughing at us.
Yeah, but the laughter is getting louder and louder.
So in my book, these creationists, they attack everyone because they don't tolerate anyone who does not accept their bizarre scriptural interpretations.
And of course, they must defend them, their dogma.
Yeah, and the Hindus were one of their victims.
Terrific. I mean, I'd hate to think that they would claim the Hindus as their fellow travelers.
Oh, no. They're going to burn in hell, according to these people.
This is such a joke, isn't it? It's so funny. Look. I hope you're laughing rather than crying about it all. It's just so ridiculous.
You know, it's funny for everyone, like you guys and everyone else in the world, but here in America, the reason it's not funny is because they just murdered an abortion doctor, one of those creationists. They are trying to get the Adam and Eve myth of creation taught in our biology classes and evolution being removed from school. And it's not funny for us because these people make up half the American population, and since we're a democracy, that means more than half of the votes.
Tell you, man, I don't think the United States of America is actually on planet Earth.
It's bad.
Because there is a psychic divide between the United States of America and the rest of the world. I tell you.
Well, we have some impressive skeptical leaders, though, that are... What happened was 9/11. That's what really woke it all up. That's when all these books, like your buddy Dawkins, and and Christopher Hitchens, and all these other skeptics came out of the woodwork and started publishing books that had these things weren't being published in the 1990s or before. But after 9/11, that's when you'll notice all the atheist literature started pouring out. And the reason
I didn't connect those two things. Why would there be a connection there?
Because 9/11 woke up the skeptics that we couldn't hide anymore and wait for society to civilize itself.
So what is what you're saying, that 9/11 was an efflorescence of Muslim fundamentalism in its most destructive mode? Is that what you're saying?
A lot of us thought that it would wake up our fundamentalists, our Christian fundamentalists, and make them see how ridiculous this is, but it didn't. they became just as entrenched as the Muslims.
Yeah. Well, of course, because this is the duality they're both existing in. They have to oppose each other. I mean, of course they do. Yeah.
They're two sides of the exact same coin.
Well, of course they are, yes.
So that means that the only ones left to do the fighting are the skeptics. And as badly outnumbered as we are, we're pouring out of our caves with lightsabers on full kill power.
Really?
Books are being published. Shows like mine are springing up all over.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we don't, what's going to happen? They aren't going to do it. They've been killing each other for 1,400 years, and they're going to keep doing it, only with more destructive weapons, weapons that can now ensure our extinction. We don't have the luxury anymore of sitting back and waiting for civilization. Either we come out and fight for it, or we go extinct.
Oh, okay. Look, a brilliant, fantastic speech. Brilliant. Just one point. From my point of view, as a determined skeptic, I'm very skeptical about civilization. I mean, the present mode of civilization is only about, 5,500 years old, you know, by which I mean cities and mass agriculture and slavery and
or writing.
Money and all that sort of thing.
I think the Jews did it best. When they use their calendar, they go back to when writing started. And that makes sense to me.
It makes big sense.
Yeah, instead of basing it on a fictional character who most of the world doesn't believe even existed, let's start the calendar when we started writing. Because if you were going to start a diary, you'd start at the first day you started writing.
Interestingly enough, the first writing, it goes back to ancient Sumeria, to about 3,500 BC, which is well before, I mean, thousands of years before the Jews got going.
But the Jews date the world at close to 6,000 years, so that's just about the time that Sumerians started writing.
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. If you look, it's fascinating. If you look at the biblical genealogies and how old the world's supposed to be according to the genealogies in the Bible, works out about 6,000 years old. Only 6,000 years, and that is how old civilization is.
And the Chinese also date the world at about 6,000.
I mean, it's fantastic. There's this universal agreement.
I prefer their system much better than ours.
Well, do you know the system I like best of all? I like the Vedic system from India, because that system sees things in terms of endless cycles of civilization, which in the end destroys itself, and then there's universal barbarism and night and darkness, and then slowly things arise again, forever, in cycles.
Well, the skeptics are trying to stave off the destruction.
Oh, man, good luck to
them. Right, good luck is right.
Look around.
Well, we don't have a choice.
What's going to stave it off?
We don't have a choice. We're outnumbered 6.5 billion to...
You're outnumbered 1,000 to 1. How's that?
Oh, it wouldn't even be close to being that good. We have less than the Jews. We're smaller than the Jews. But it doesn't matter how badly we're outnumbered. Either we come out and fight for it, or we just sit back and let it happen.
militant. There's two things going on here. Okay, there's skepticism, right? And then there's kind of militant scientific materialism. Now, from my point of view, perhaps not from yours, they don't mean the same thing. I mean, I am skeptical of scientific materialism, and I'm not a religious fundamental. So I hope you understand that. I'm not trying to promote anything, saying that science itself, from my point of view, has certain assumptions behind it that are either unexamined or unprovable. And is it okay? I'll put it on two levels. I'll do it very quickly so I won't waste your time. All right. Okay, I'll make this very quick because I'm challenging you here. Right. Okay. One of the assumptions of materialistic science is that the basis of reality is the material universe, and that mind, you and me talking, thinking, using words, is a subset of mental activity, which is a subset of brain activity, which is a subset of the accidental collision of atoms. In other words...
We have to back up.
Okay, go ahead.
Where the part where you said accidental.
Well, the accidental, evolution is meant to be accidental. It's just like...
No. That's a creationist argument. Accidental is not what science or evolution says. No, I'm going to give you a specific example so that it's easier to understand. The 1953 Miller-Urey experiment, where for so long creationists always said they thought they were so safe by saying, well, you'll never create life from non-life. You've got to have God. You can't have organic things develop from inorganic. Well,
yep, I know that. Yep.
Then Miller proved that you can, that they were wrong. And it just, they've been spending the last 56 years fighting with everything they can to try to discredit that experiment. The only problem is scientists all over the world have been able to duplicate that experiment. Now,
create life in a test tube, really?
Yeah. You
that's
said
news to me.
You said accidental. Well, the thing is, if it's accidental, you wouldn't be able to have scientists all over the world recreating the experiment if it was an accident. The reason
you're saying that the experiment created life from inorganic material.
Yes, but what the creationists used to get around that as an excuse, because Miller did it, they try to redefine the word life. They want you to produce like a dog, a living creature. Well, evolution...
I want you to produce a replicating organism, even a paramecium or a self-respecting single-celled animalcule. But I don't think this produced one of those.
Evolution does not say that. Evolution does not say that inorganic materials will produce a single-celled organism. There are incredible number of steps, eons of time in between those two things.
What did this experiment produce if it wasn't a single-celled...
Do you have your internet up right now?
I do. I'd appreciate a reference.
Go to Wikipedia.
Okay, I'm on the job now. I've got a very fast computer. Just give me a moment. I'll be there in a sec. Well, what I Google, and then Wikipedia is always number one, so
okay.
What do I look up?
Type in Miller-Urey experiment.
Miller-dash or hyphen?
Either one.
How do you spell Urey?
U-R-E-Y.
U-R-E-Y. Urey experiment?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and answer your question while you're doing that.
Hang on. I've just typed it in, and then start experiment. Yeah, go.
Okay.
I'm listening.
Okay, what they produced was amino acids, lipids, and sugars. Now.
Yeah, I knew that already. I was taught that at school.
If you're familiar with the classification of the world of life and everything,
yeah.
There's life and non-life at the very, very top. And then if you go down life, you've got all the branches. But between life and non-life,
yeah.
The three things I mentioned, amino acids, lipids, and sugars, are in the domain of life. They're not in the domain of non-life.
Sugar is in the domain of life, is it? Okay.
Sugar is not in the domain of non-life. Amino acids are not in the domain of non-life. They are in the life domain. What happened was he started with inorganic chemicals, which you can see there are carbon, hydrogen, ammonia, whatever.
Yeah, whatever.
There was nothing from the domain of life, only from the domain of non-life, which is what you would have when the earth first formed. You wouldn't have life. You would just have the elements that coalesced from the nova that preceded it.
If you accept the idea of cosmic evolution, of course, that's assuming.
That's what most scientists accept, so I'm going to go with that.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean they're right.
No.
So I'm skeptical of the whole thing.
Right, but then that means you're going to have to take the position, a different position.
Well, it doesn't mean I have to take a Christian fundamentalist position. And by the way, I'm not a fundamentalist. So if you're giving me an argument against creationism, and it's a good argument. I'm not a creationist. So this argument is not valid against what I was going to say. But even it's good to run over it because you're quite right.
Life was created from non-life. Or, no, not was created, it created itself. The elements of inorganic elements combined, and on that webpage it'll tell you exactly how the experiment was done using electricity to simulate lightning through an atmosphere. And what was produced were the building blocks of life. Now, how creationists get around this is they try to say, well, we want a paramecium or an amoeba. Well, evolution doesn't say that the inorganic elements is going to produce a paramecium. It was proven in the Miller experiment that it will produce amino acids, lipids, and sugars. Millions of years are then required, maybe even billions. Incredible amounts of time of evolution where these things turn into replicating molecules. And if you want, the creationists tried
to... That's just an idea. It's just a theory.
No, because...
You can't prove it.
I'm going to give you another website. If you go to Julius Rebeck, R-E-B-E-K.
Yeah, pardon me. I'm going to do it. Excuse me. I've just got to type it in before you go on. Excuse
and then,
me.
Yeah, then add them to your favorites.
J-U-L-I-U-S. R-double-E?
No, R... I think it's R-single-E, B-E-K.
Oh, okay. Hang on. I'm just typing it in. Here I go. I've typed it in, and I've got the Rebeck Laboratory homepage.
Okay, good. He has...
Combinatorial chemistry and self-assembling systems.
He has produced what they tried to claim, the replicating molecules.
Well, or has he done it on a computer an organic lab?
You can go ahead and investigate that website. But even if they didn't, if something takes millions of years to evolve, you're not probably going to be able to do that in a couple of years in a laboratory. You know, that's not how evolution works. However, Miller was able to do it in 1 week. And Rebeck has been able to do it. So they're making incredible strides, but many of these things take incredible amounts of time, and this all began when you used the word accidental, and there's no...
Ah, well, okay. I don't have to use that. I threw that in as one verbal stimulus. It doesn't have to be accidental. It could be deliberate.
Well, the reason it's not accidental is because these things are obeying the physical laws of chemistry and physics.
The laws. Who made the laws?
It doesn't matter who made the laws. Well, a creationist would say God made the laws.
Yeah, well, I'm asking you.
Yeah, well, and how would I know that?
Well, you say there are laws.
Right.
And I've never heard of a law without a lawgiver.
I don't think there's a human alive who knows who made the laws, although religious people will claim that they do.
But I would say, as a skeptic, that if you show me a law, I'll say, who made the law? And if you can't answer that, I'll say you may not know, but someone or something did.
So?
Because nothing can happen without something causing it.
Well, that's not true. Quantum physics and quantum mechanics is still trying to determine the answer to that question.
Yeah, they haven't done it, have they?
Right. So far, there are deterministic causes and non-deterministic causes.
Mm-hmm.
And so something does not have to be caused deterministically. Something can arise in the quantum world through the, in this case, accident, or random is actually a better word, because it's not accidental.
Random is the word. Good.
Yeah, but through the random fluctuations.
One physicist put it, the random concatenation of atoms.
Well, I don't know if they're atoms, but just the random activity that if you take a number of possibilities and one is chosen, for instance, well, I won't go into for instance, but if one is chosen, then that wasn't caused by anything in particular. It was just the result of a random choice among many possible outcomes. So,
well, there you are. That's why I put in that original thing about the accidental collision of whatevers, because, you know, that is one of the ways of looking at things. So
but they're not
we're in agreement at last.
Well, but they're not accidental. They're based on laws.
Well,
and just
random,
because
then.
Just because I don't know who made the laws has nothing to do with the fact that scientists have discovered these laws. Like,
you know, if I come back to my home after a journey and discover that someone's broken into my house and stolen my television set, I don't know who did it, but I know someone did it.
That's what I'm saying.
Good. Well, hell, we're not arguing at all. Well, thank you very much. And this has been a most entertaining and enlightening conversation. Thank you so much, and I bid you good night.
Are you ready, Goose?